The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your often bi-weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined this week by IJ Litigators Robert Everett Johnson and Diana Simpson. If you enjoy our humble podcast, please do us a solid and review us on iTunes. If you're new to the show, the basic idea is this. We discuss three or four recent Federal Circuit Court opinions. Why the circuit courts? Because the Supreme Court only accepts a handful of cases each year, and many important and interesting cases are ultimately decided in the courts of appeals. So with that, let's start things off in the Tenth Circuit. Robert Everett Johnson.
All right, so this is an eminent domain case. It involves a couple, Nasreen and Saeed Kolgi, who own a carpet store in a city called Glendale in Colorado. In addition to owning this carpet store, they also own a series of other properties kind of around the store. And the store and these other properties are all located by the river. And one of the reasons that they bought these properties, in addition to wanting to have a place to have their business, is they saw the long-term development potential of this property that's located in this scenic place by the river. Now, it turns out the city saw the long-term development potential of this property as well, and they were interested in bringing in a developer to develop the area and essentially cutting out the Kolgis, who had owned the property. So the Kolgis keep making proposals for, here's what we want to do to develop this property. None of this is in the opinion, by the way, it's just background. Here's what we want to do to develop this property. And the city keeps saying, well, no, you can't do that. Then the city brings in this other developer with a sweetheart deal to develop the property. And the city holds a proceeding where they then declare this property blighted. Now, the property is not really blighted. It doesn't look bad. It's not, it's not falling down in the way that you might think that blighted suggests that it is. It is underdeveloped, but that's because the city keeps saying no to all of these development proposals and denying all the necessary permits to actually develop the property. So the property is declared blighted. What does that mean? Well, it means that suddenly all of this property is at risk for the use of eminent domain. But the Kolgis don't know that because they ask the city, a city attorney, well, we've been told there's going to be a hearing on this blight issue. Do we need to attend? The city attorney says no, it's not really a big deal. And then nobody even tells them that their property has been declared blighted. And then the final wrinkle is, once your property has been declared blighted, you only have 30 days to challenge that designation. And once that 30 days is gone, you can't challenge it at all.
Right. So you have a 30-day window to find a lawyer, and you have no idea. I mean, it's a trap for the unwary in that, you have no idea that the implication of the blight designation could be eminent domain, and for up to 7 whole years.
Right, exactly. So it's basically, the government's basically trying to take away your right to contest the eminent domain before you even know that the eminent domain is happening. And in this case, it's particularly egregious because not only would you have no reason to think that the blight designation means that your property could be subject to eminent domain, and not only would you have any reason to think that you only have 30 days, but in this case, they didn't even get notice that the blight designation had happened. So the Kolgis sue.
Well, actually, I want to hop in real fast and say that it took them about 6 months to even find out that the blight designation had happened. So basically, the property owners were told by the city attorney, don't worry about the hearing, not a big deal. So they didn't. They took his advice, his or her advice. And 6 months later, come to find out that actually their property had been designated blighted, and the time had since passed for them to really do anything about it. And so now for the next 6.5 years, they had to worry about an eminent domain action happening, and in the interim, that's not without effect. In the interim, they couldn't really develop their property. They couldn't really sell it very well. It would decrease the value of the property for that entire 7-year period, all with the specter of eminent domain hanging in the background. And so when they find out about it, they're obviously quite worried and quite upset. So they hop in and they decide to sue the city of Glendale. And the district court basically said, you don't really have an opportunity here. That's, what the city did was perfectly acceptable. Go away. And the Tenth Circuit really rejected that. The Tenth Circuit looked at whether there was a due process right in having the opportunity to get notice about the blight designation and then everything that flows from that. And it sounds interesting when you start looking into the opinion, they talk about what kind of due process right there is. And it's a procedural due process right, which requires there to be a property interest in the hearing for you to be able to invoke the procedural due process rights. And it sounds really strange to say that you have a property in, you have a property interest in a hearing, but that's how the court ends up ruling, that that the statute has created this this right to sue the government, and you don't know that this right, the clock is ticking on this right until you get the notice. But since they didn't send you the notice in the first place, you have no idea.
Yeah, and there's a sort of interesting question here too. The city says, well, there's this Supreme Court case from the 20s that holds that in an eminent domain case, it's enough to just publish the notice in the newspaper. And so the city wants to say, look, like, we don't actually have to send notice to anybody because under this case, it's enough that we just publish the notice somewhere. Now, there's two problems with that. One is that it turns out they didn't even publish the notice in the newspaper. So, you know, sort of like irrelevant case to begin with. But the 10th Circuit actually goes a little deeper than that and says, look, it may have been the case that in the 1920s that publication in a newspaper was enough to inform something that something important was happening. You know, they don't say that it was, but they just say, look, their conditions in the 1920s might have meant that that actually was effective. But today, given the volume of stuff that's being published in newspapers and given the role of print newspapers in our society, the idea that you have notice just because something is printed in your hometown newspaper is kind of absurd, right? I mean, who even reads the newspaper anymore?
I certainly don't read the hard copy. I read the articles, but that's about it. So the upshot of this opinion really is that the government owes you notice when they enter into this blight designation. And so the 10th Circuit kind of split the baby a little bit and said that the government isn't required to tell you that you only have 30 days to challenge that blight designation, that's kind of, you know what the laws are. You have the perfect ability to access what the laws are, and the government just has to provide you the notice, and then you have to go figure out what your time limits are on that. But
and that's really the sort of dark cloud of this ruling. I mean, it's on the whole, it's a really great ruling, but given that part of it, you sort of question, how much does it really mean? I mean, if the government can satisfy its obligations by saying, hey, your property has been declared blighted, but doesn't have to actually tell you, you know, what that means or what you would, how you go about challenging that, or even that you have 30 days to challenge it. You could see a lot of people falling into this trap that, like, they don't really realize the significance of it. They don't realize that they have to get a lawyer.
And you also have a circuit split now created on that question, because the Second Circuit has held in an IJ case that you have to notify about a 30-day window if you're going to have one.
That's right. Yeah, IJ had a case in New York called the Brody versus the Village of Port Chester, where the Second Circuit said, not only are you entitled to notice, but you're entitled to notice of all these legal details. And that really makes sense, right? I mean, yes, absolutely, people are charged with notice of the law, but it's not really notice to send somebody a piece of paper that says, hey, like, this arcane thing has happened to you. That doesn't point out, like, why that matters or how long you have to respond to it.
Or what procedures you're entitled to or any of it, really. It's just they could be sending a form letter that does nothing more than just say, hey, your property's been blighted, thanks, bye. And that's just not enough, I don't think, under the Constitution. And that's not what the Second Circuit thinks is enough, but the Tenth Circuit sure does.
So what that means for a property owner is you get this notice and you have to scramble to find a lawyer. You wouldn't necessarily know that you would need to scramble to find a lawyer because you have no idea that this triggers eminent domain.
So the Colgies win anyway. So this isn't a case that could go up to the Supreme Court, but we do now have an interesting circuit split on this question. And maybe in another case, we could see this issue going up.
I think as a general rule of thumb, it's a good idea to, if you ever get a letter from the government talking about your property and perhaps some decision has been made about it, you should contact a lawyer, figure something out very quickly, because your rights are probably on the line.
Okay. And with that, let's move on to the Fourth Circuit. Diana?
Okay. So out of the Fourth Circuit, we have this decision about a guy named Hamza Kolsuz, who is a Turkish citizen who has come to the U.S. several times and been arrested most recently and been convicted of trying to take firearms parts in his luggage outside of the United States without a particular license that you need to have in order to do this. And so the government had previously been involved with the defendant here in two different instances in which he had come to the United States and then tried to leave with different firearms parts in his luggage. And so he has done it again, and he was caught at Dulles with a bunch of different firearms parts in his luggage. And so the Customs and Border Patrol arrested him and took his phone, took his luggage, took everything. And they did a search of his phone while he was right there with them. And that was just a standard search. He didn't have a password protection on it. They just kind of looked through the phone. But then they took the phone away and took it off-site about 4 miles away from Dulles Airport and did an in-depth search of the phone that took about a month. And with this search, they looked at everything and produced a 900-page report almost that included literally everything on his phone, including GPS coordinates of where he'd been, contacts, messages, emails, pictures he'd taken. Basically, anything that's on your phone, they were able to get that. And so they charged this man with conspiracy to smuggle arms out and all of these other things. And he moved to suppress the phone search, that second phone search where they downloaded all the information off site, saying that this was not under the exception to the warrant rule for border searches. And so that's what this particular case is about. And the Fourth Circuit basically says that this particular search was probably fine, but they announce a new rule for the future.
Yeah. And so this is interesting. I mean, there's sort of, I think to fully understand this case, you have to talk just very briefly about the Supreme Court's decision in Riley recently. And the question in Riley, basically, in this case here, the government is arguing that they're able to search this phone without a warrant because it's pursuant to the border exception to the warrant requirement. Yeah, right. And so Riley involved a different exception to the Fourth Amendment, involved the incident to arrest exception. And so the government's argument in Riley was, well, if we arrest you, we get to search everything that you have incident to the arrest. And if you have a cell phone on you, we can search your cell phone, and it's just a search incident to the arrest. And what the Supreme Court said was, no, that doesn't work. The search incident to arrest is to make sure that people are not carrying guns or things that could harm the officers. It's not to, like, go through everything in their cell phone in order to get a complete picture of their digital life. Now, you would think that Riley would be dispositive here, right? And what the Supreme Court said in Riley was, well, if you're searching somebody's phone, even if it's incident to arrest, you still need to get a warrant. But what the Fourth Circuit says is no. If you're at the border, then suddenly Riley doesn't apply. We can search your phone without a warrant, even though you would think, right? The reason for the border exception to the Fourth Amendment is that you can't possibly require a warrant to search every car that's going across the border. You need to have a system of sort of regular randomized searches in order to make sure that people aren't taking contraband across. It's kind of like when you go into the airport, or in fact, this was at the airport. It was an international airport. Everybody goes through the X-ray machine, and you can't require a warrant to require somebody to go through the X-ray machine at the airport. It just wouldn't be practicable. You wouldn't be able to advance the interest of promoting the safety on the airlines, right? But that interest has no relationship to taking the search of this phone. Like, they're not preventing contraband from going across the border by searching the phone, except in this very attenuated sense where the crime that he is charged with is taking contraband across the border.
And this area of case law, there's the normal searches that are allowed at the border. And so those are just, pretty standard searches. There's no need for a warrant, no need for individualized suspicion, any of that. But then there's this category of searches called non-routine searches. And these do require individualized suspicion. And this includes very intrusive body searches. So not just going through the metal detector, but looking inside, for instance, destructive property searches, and then other particularly offensive searches, or searches done in particularly offensive manners. And so this non-routine search requires some form of individualized suspicion. It still doesn't require a warrant, but that's what's really at issue here in this case and in this particular search.
Yeah, well, so the Fourth Circuit says even though you don't need a warrant, you at least need individualized suspicion. Now, I still think that's setting the bar too low. I mean, the searches where you can get away with just individualized suspicion are searches at the border, like where somebody's going across the border, and in addition to the regular search of you of their car, you have some basis to suspect that they're hiding something, like, say, under a panel in the trunk. So you have this special reason to not just sort of give this car the normal search, but to actually, like, pry off the panel of the trunk in a way that you wouldn't normally do. But that's still a search that's happening at the border. Here, this isn't a search that's happening at the border. This guy is arrested, then the phone is taken away, and it's sent to this other location where they do this huge forensic analysis. And, I mean, really, it's a search incident to arrest, the same thing that was at issue in Riley, right? Like, they wouldn't have done this unless this guy was arrested. It's not like you're just taking phones from all these people at the border and saying, okay, go on your merry way, but we're going to keep your phone for the next month to do a forensic analysis of it. So the holding in Riley really should have been controlling, but okay, fine. So individualized suspicion is at least better than nothing. It's half a loaf, right?
Maybe a third of a loaf. It's interesting because I think that they could have gotten a warrant in this case. I think it's likely they could have gotten a warrant. This is a guy who Customs and Border Patrol had known about. They had alerted staff at Dulles that he was coming through because he had twice been caught with all of these firearms parts. And so this was his third time. They opened his suitcase just like they were allowed to and found more firearms parts. I don't imagine a world in which they couldn't have gotten a warrant to search his phone. And so maybe they didn't even really need to decide that particular question here. Should they have gotten a warrant? Probably. I think, at least in my opinion. And so what the court ends up doing is saying, well, you know, whether this requires more than reasonable suspicion is not something we have to answer because the agents here relied on precedent at the time. And so we're not going to go any further than that, which I think is a bit of a cop out. But that's the way the precedent lets them do it. But then there's this very interesting concurrence by Judge Wilkinson who just goes through and says, oh, well, this isn't for courts. This is for the legislature, which, you know, I think we can all anticipate he does from time to time. He does seem to write these kinds of opinions, but that, you know, this is the question of border security is one primarily for the other branches, not the judiciary.
Yeah, and this is really quite a concurrence. I mean, he basically says, you know, we have no idea what the dangers are that we're dealing with, and there's some language in here that just, you know, I think he acknowledges. He says, am I being hyperbolic? Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, his view is, well, even if there's a risk of all these dangers, then, you know, that we should be worried about that. He says lethal capabilities are advancing at a rapid pace. And he refers to the threat of terrorism and, you know, I guess an international arms race. And he says, you know, we have to have this security because of all these threats. You know, I think the sort of answer to that, though, is look, like, as Diana suggested, it would have been easy to get a warrant in this case. So it's not like the requirement of a warrant or even the requirement. I mean, Wilkinson is saying individualized suspicion is too much. But it just seems crazy. I mean, if there's a threat, if you have any reason to think there's a threat, then sure, get a warrant. But the idea that there's these sort of threats floating out there and we have to dispense with the Fourth Amendment entirely, I just don't see that.
Is it Wilkinson's position that you just can do this forensic search of anybody's phone on a whim?
I mean, that seems to be what he's saying, that he seems to be saying that absent some kind of a statute, individualized suspicion should not be required. And what that would seem to imply would be you can take anybody's phone. You know, it doesn't matter if you have any suspicion that they've done anything wrong. And you can take it and you can subject it to this analysis. And his response to, you know, the obvious concern that would infringe people's privacy as well. If you're going on an international trip, just don't bring your cell phone with you.
Burner phones for everybody.
I wonder, maybe he doesn't own a smartphone. I don't know.
Well, anyway, his opinion is not the controlling one here. You can still bring your smartphones. Just hope the authorities don't develop any kind of individualized suspicion.
Yeah, you know, one last thing to point out here. I mean, individualized suspicion may sound like some sort of real standard, but You know, to get a warrant, the standard is probable cause. And every lawyer knows probable cause is like nothing. Like, you can get anything as probable cause. It's a very low standard. Individualized suspicion is way less than probable cause. So we're talking about a very low standard in order to do this kind of search.
Okay. With that, let's move on to the final case, which comes out of the Third Circuit. Rob?
Yeah, so this is a case involving a gentleman. His name is Levi Lapp Stoltfus, and he is a Amish gentleman from Pennsylvania.
Formerly Amish
gentleman from Pennsylvania. He had his life savings, about $500,000, that he had in cash, and he wanted to deposit it in the bank. How he earned that money is sort of, I think, not consequential to the decision. The decision doesn't really say how he earned it. All we know from the decision itself is this is his life savings. He knows that every time you make a cash deposit over $10,000, there's a form that is filled out that goes to the government, and he doesn't want that form to go to the government. What he tells a later investigator is that he wanted no part of a government investigation or harassment. So in order to avoid these reports, he deposits the cash in installments of $9,000 each. That, as some people may know, is a federal crime called structuring. Essentially, the banks are required to report transactions over $10,000. And so if you deposit less than $10,000, you are committing a crime by evading the filing of a report. Now, Stoltfus is prosecuted under a state law that essentially incorporates the federal offense of structuring. He's convicted, and then he files a federal habeas petition.
Yeah, so he was convicted basically of 58 counts of structuring under the state law, and he was sentenced to somewhere between 2 and 10 years in prison and assessed a civil penalty of $540,200, which is equivalent to $900 less than his life savings. And so he, as Rob said, filed a series of appeals from this. He appealed both within the state courts, where he was not successful, and then he filed a habeas petition that this case is on appeal from the district court's second decision in the habeas petition. So there's a lot procedurally going on in this case, but the important part is that he's up on a habeas appeal right now. But the only thing that the court addresses is whether this statute is unconstitutionally overbroad or there are other as-applied constitutional arguments. What is specifically not at issue in this decision is whether the Eighth Amendment and its excessive fines clause is violated by the civil penalty that he's been assessed. And so basically the court gets rid of his arguments pretty quickly. Overbreadth is not something that has ever been applied in the First Amendment, and the court declines to do so here.
Or outside the First Amendment.
So, excuse me, that's what I meant.
Overbreadth, in the First Amendment context, right, the overbreadth doctrine is that there's, say you have a law that prohibits a huge amount of speech that is constitutionally protected, but it also applies to a smaller amount of speech that is not constitutionally protected. And you have somebody who goes to court and they're complaining about this law. Their conduct is actually totally fine to prohibit, or their speech is totally fine to prohibit. But this law is way overbroad. And what the overbreadth doctrine says is you can strike down a law because it prohibits a bunch of protected speech, even if the plaintiff's speech is not protected. What the court is saying is that doctrine doesn't apply to the criminal law.
Why doesn't the excessive fines clause get brought up here? Because it seems like, even if he's 100% guilty, losing $500,000 is a pretty steep fine.
It is. And that's, that's the way that this country's habeas jurisprudence exists now. So the way that you can file challenges to your conviction. You're allowed to file a habeas petition in district court, but then you have to get approval to basically appeal that decision. And so through a series of missteps on his own and then after he was appointed counsel, he did not sufficiently appeal the Eighth Amendment claim that he wanted to make. And so the Third Circuit here did not grant a certification of appealability, which is what's required to do a habeas case, for the Eighth Amendment argument. They do drop this interesting footnote suggesting that that actually might be unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. It says the Eighth Amendment argument Stoltzfus made below is therefore outside the scope of the certificate of appealability. Although the $540,200 civil penalty imposed on Stoltzfus, nearly his entire life savings, does appear unusually harsh, our role on habeas review gives us no basis to review it. So perhaps if he had litigated this differently, you know, that would be the focus of this case. You know, it's almost there, but it's just not.
There is one other interesting aspect of this case, and that involves his quote-unquote as-applied challenge. And what he's basically saying is, look, in order to convict somebody of a crime, you should be required to show that they had some sort of criminal state of mind, that they actually not just did something bad, but that they had what's called mens rea, or that they, which means, you know, that they knew they were doing something bad, that they, or that they intended to do something bad, and that we don't put people in jail for kind of stumbling into a crime, right? The sort of problem with this argument that he runs into is, well, the statute actually does require some sort of knowledge, and the knowledge that's required to be guilty of structuring is that you actually know that the government requires banks to file these $10,000 reports. So if you're filing, if you're making under $10,000 cash deposits, but you have no idea that this reporting requirement exists, then that's not a crime. You have to actually know that these reports are out there and that they're required to be filed. So that's well enough. But if you dig a little deeper, I think there is a serious problem with the structuring laws and with the mens rea that they require. It just takes a little bit of effort to see it. And that's this. The mens rea is not that you know, you don't have to know that it's illegal to avoid the reports. You just have to know that the reporting requirement exists. So it's essentially saying that if you know that there is this government paperwork out there, and then you take any step to avoid that paperwork, that is a crime, even if you don't know that avoiding the paperwork is a crime, right? So normally in life, people go around trying to avoid government paperwork all the time, right? Like, you know that paperwork is required if you get a if you want to, you know, get a certain business license. Well, gee, is there a way I can structure my business so I don't have to get that license? You know that government, that paperwork is required if you issue a security in a certain kind of way. Okay, fine, I just won't issue the security in that way so that I don't have to fill out that paperwork. And this is what people do, right? People are constantly structuring their behavior to avoid government paperwork because government paperwork is a pain. And what the structuring law is essentially saying is that it is a crime if you know that this government paperwork exists to avoid filling it out or to avoid having it be filled out. That is a very weird crime. It's like saying, it's almost like saying that it's a crime to drive under the speed limit because you know that the speed limit exists. It's not clear to me that that really meets the Constitution's requirements. Now, you know, habeas review is very limited, and I think it would be hard to strike down the structuring laws in the context of a habeas petition from a state conviction. But what's weird about this opinion is it doesn't just say that habeas denied it. It basically says, you know, this argument is so meritless that it doesn't even matter if it was reviewed on a de novo standard or if it's reviewed on a habeas standard. It just fails. And I think they're displaying a certain lack of sensitivity to the problems with the structuring laws there.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time for more judicial engagement. Until then, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, bolstering you to get engaged.